The next months will see the establishment of a political council to assist in the management of Iraq's government.
And people are saying, already are saying, that this is a collective punishment. They came to punish us, not to liberate us.
If there was a point of contamination, let's say the U.S. primary school, the school would be evacuated, the contamination would be removed, and there would be hell to pay. Why should 900 Iraqi children be treated any differently?
The definition of news is when something bad happens to somebody, according to the news experts that we talk to. If it bleeds, it leads.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, June 25th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush reacted skeptically today to a reported agreement by Palestinian militants to halt attacks on Israelis for 3 months. "I'll believe it when I see it," Bush said. Bush demanded that Hamas and groups like it be taken out of business. Quote, "The true test for Hamas and terrorist organizations is the complete dismantlement of their terrorist networks, their capacity to blow up the peace process," Bush said at a news conference with European Union leaders. We'll have a full report on Peace Watch from the Gaza later this afternoon. A top State Department expert on chemical and biological weapons told congressional committees in closed-door hearings that he had been pressed to tailor his analysis on Iraq and other matters to conform with the Bush administration's views. Several congressional officials reported today. The officials described what they said was a dramatic moment at a House Intelligence Committee hearing last week when the weapons expert came forward to tell Congress he had felt such pressure. By speaking out, they said, the senior intelligence expert identified by several officials as Christian Westerman became the first member of the intelligence community on active service to make this sort of admission to members of Congress. The House Intelligence Committee was examining questions concerning the Bush administration's handling of pre-war reports on evidence that Iraq had illegal weapons and ties to terrorist groups. Mr. Westerman, officials said, is an analyst in the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, a small but important office at the State Department that is intended to provide the Secretary of State with intelligence analysis independent of the CIA and other agencies. He told lawmakers last week that while he felt pressure, he never actually changed the wording of any of his intelligence reports. He did not immediately provide lawmakers with details about his complaints, and it remains uncertain the degree to which his concerns related to Iraq or other regional issues. Members of the environmental group Greenpeace visited the Tuwaitha nuclear plant near Baghdad yesterday. Their mission was to assess the extent of damage and radioactive contamination caused by looters in the wake of the U.S. bombing campaign. The activists say that what they found was quite disturbing. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Mike Townsley, a Greenpeace campaigner currently in Baghdad.
What we found in the towns and villages is some very high levels of radioactive contamination. The point that we found just outside the school was 3,000 times the background level, the normal level you would find anywhere else. We found a point in a house which was 10,000 times background level. Further to that, a large container full of radioactive yellow cake or uranium oxide.
Where did you find this large container? I understand I'm looking at a report that says the canister was about the size of a small car and contained this yellow cake that you're referring to. Where was it located and why?
Maybe about 2 kilometers from the front entrance to Tuwaitha on a large open space, public land. And when we actually found it, there was maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 children just playing in that general area. I guess people know by now that the Tuwaitha nuclear facility was left unguarded for a number of weeks after the fall of Baghdad. The communities around the plant are the poorest communities in Iraq. They went in, they took what they could. They took a lot of canisters, drums that were used for storing radioactive waste. Mostly they took the waste out, and what they desperately needed was any kind of container to store water, to store food. They had no idea what they were taking.
So they're completely oblivious to the dangers maintained there in that facility, obviously, for many years, or they would never have gone in and looted it in that manner.
Yeah, I mean, these are very essentially uneducated people, desperate people, poor people. You know, the situation in Iraq is not good. Anything that can be used to store water in is invaluable to them. All they saw were 500 blue, free water containers.
What are the consequences of them actually using those radioactive containers to store water in?
Cancer and transgenerational birth defects such as Down syndrome, hair loss, etc.
How significant is this, and how much potential danger does it pose to the people in the broader area, even those who perhaps were not using the containers?
Basically, uranium oxide is a powder. If it's airborne, if it's breathed in, then it gets stuck in the lungs. Then it's basically constantly going to be a threat of cancer. The trouble is that we don't actually know the full extent of the contamination, the full extent of the danger, because nobody has bothered to do a full environmental contamination survey or a public health analysis. And that's why Greenpeace has come. We've come to see for ourselves. What we've found is very, very frightening. We're a team of six people. We're not the International Atomic Energy Agency, the world's nuclear policemen. They're exactly the people who should be in the Tueta villages and towns right now, conducting an environmental study, public health study, and figuring out how to decontaminate and remediate.
Why haven't we heard anything from the IAEA investigators? Why aren't they insisting that they be allowed to do a thorough investigation, or are they?
I would like to hear from the IAEA now. I'd like the IAEA to shout from the rooftops, get out of our way. Let us do the job that we're here for. Let us assess the situation. Let us help the people around Tueta. Let us decontaminate.
Your team, the Greenpeace team, found radiation levels 10,000 times the normal level in some homes and 3,000 times the normal level outside of a school. And you're saying that the kids are playing in areas where these open canisters are, and there's actually this yellow cake in these canisters, and
yeah,
the villagers are using these canisters to store their drinking water. How serious is this matter, and what should be being done to protect the people?
In any other country, it would be being dealt with right now. We actually lifted, we sealed and lifted the canister, and we took it to Tueta. We took it to the U.S. military checkpoint around the inner core of Tueta.
Mm-hmm.
We explained the situation, and they acted like human beings in a very honorable fashion, and they said, we need to take this inside. We need to take it out of the community and inside. We met with a lieutenant colonel who's heading up a radiation protection team for the troops inside to make sure they're safe. And he agreed to come with me back into the community so I could show him the point that was 10,000 times background. He and his team then proceeded to take that back into the site to make that small area safe. But he has no off-site mandate. On a very human level, when the situation was explained to him, he recognized the danger, he agreed with our findings, and he said to me, and on record, that he believes the IAEA should be immediately allowed back in to do the job. So if we can convince the sentry on the gate, if we can convince the lieutenant colonel in charge of the radiation, then we just hope that these guys can convince Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush to act like human beings.
Have you tried to contact Paul Bremer with your findings?
I sent an email to ORHA, which is the occupying government.
Yes.
Because that's the only route I know in. In the next days, I intend to try and contact U.S. officials inside the Bremer administration. I also intend to contact Iraqi Defense Ministry officials. I've been here for only 10 days. I've been tied up with trying to get something done about the points of radiation we found. I expected to be able to conduct a widespread survey. Every time I stepped out of the car, there was something so frightening that I had to stop. At that point, stop the survey and attempt to make it safe. So we haven't conducted a white survey because, as I say, every time we get out of the car, we get stuck on a clear and present danger.
Does this Tueta facility pose a threat beyond Tueta? Does the contamination threaten to harm those in Baghdad as well?
There is one area that the looted nuclear material from Tueta could pose a threat. This plant not only had yellow cake, some radioactive waste, it also contained something called industrial sources or industrial isotopes. A number of them could be used for so-called dirty bombs. A number of those are missing. Question is, where have they gone?
One guy is quoted in this article in the Agence France-Presse as saying. He's a 41-year-old council member from the Tuatha City Council. Yeah. And he says it's too late for them. The damage is already done. Do you agree with that?
It's never too late to clean up. Some people will have received a radiation dose. Some people will have ingested yellow cake. But if there's yellow cake in the environment, then future victims, future people, can be protected from it by having it removed. It's never too late for an environmental cleanup. But absolutely, some damage is already done.
Have you actually met any people suffering from the initial effects of being exposed to these high levels of radiation?
Yes. Now, this is a very complicated subject. Radiation sickness, key indicators, nosebleeds, lethargy, tiredness, and skin discoloration. You're talking about a population of about 5,000 to 10,000 people who are chronically poor. Key signs of being chronically poor, lethargy, nosebleeds, skin discoloration. It's very difficult without the proper medical equipment and the proper expertise that only the International Atomic Energy Agency and the international community can bring to isolate the radiation sicknesses from general impact of chronic poverty. But anecdotally and instinctively, there's radiation in the environment. There are clear indicators of early stages of radiation sickness. I don't want to wait until all of the facts are in place. I want to see a precautionary principle applied. I want to see the Iraqi people treated exactly the same way as U.S. school children would be treated. If there was a point contamination outside a U.S. primary school that was kicking out 3,000 times background, the school would be evacuated, the contamination would be removed, and there would be hell to pay to find out where that source came from. Why should 900 Iraqi children be treated any differently?
Mike Townsley is a member of the environmental group Greenpeace. Along with several other activists, he toured Iraq's Tuatha nuclear facility and prepared a survey documenting what the group calls frightening levels of radioactive contamination. The topic of Iraq's post-war construction dominated discussions at last weekend's World Economic Forum meeting held in Jordan. The Middle East Quartet, comprising of the U.S., the European Union, the United Nations, and Russia, yesterday sought to renew hope that a Middle East peace roadmap can be saved despite the acts of violence that are undermining the plan. Meeting near the Dead Sea on Sunday, the quartet said all efforts should be exerted to revive peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians. Peace Watch correspondent Ula Farawadi files this report.
The U.S. has finally spelled out its plans for the future Iraq. Speaking at the World Economic Forum, the U.S. Civilian Administrator of Iraq, Paul Bremer, said the U.S. has put a three-step plan for the future Iraq, a political council to rule the country, an army, and a constitution. U.S. Administrator Bremer.
As we provide for Iraq's security, we have begun its political transformation, and this is our second task. The next months will see the establishment of a political council to assist in the management of Iraq's government. The political council will be representative of all the major strands of Iraqi society. It will have real authority from its first day. It will nominate ministry heads and form commissions to recommend policies concerning issues significant to Iraq's future.
Bremer announced to the audience of international diplomats and trade representatives during the Davos summit in Jordan that the U.S. would be managing the resources of Iraq until the prerequisites for security and political stability are in place. Amnesty International issued a special report criticizing the occupying powers of the U.S. Anglo-Central Command and their future plans. The report said it was worrying that neither the Central Command created Iraq Development Fund nor the International Advisory and Monitoring Board is a proper international body with clear international accountability. The board was formed to ensure the transparent disbursement of Iraqi funds and is composed of representatives of international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. Although a UN resolution lifted sanctions on Iraq and created these two bodies, neither body need report to the UN Security Council. This, according to Amnesty International, overrides existing international law, which prohibits occupying powers from selling or transferring the natural resources of the territory they occupy. Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa said an advisory council was not enough.
And a government in Iraq would tremendously add to the credibility of the development in Iraq, more than the continuation of the existing system. And I don't think the general public opinion in the Arab world would understand this idea of the council as an advisory council. That is not enough. I believe a government, and you go directly to that goal, not to move sideways.
Iraq's former Foreign Minister Adnan Barjiji, who is widely expected to lead the U.S. proposed council, said Iraqis were anxious to manage their own affairs as soon as possible, and that they need to have a government of their own choosing and a constitution that guarantees human rights under the rule of law.
So Iraqis will have to be involved in the whole process of government, of preparing for the political council, which we hope will be established on the basis of representation, a broadly based representation of all the strains of Iraqi society. This will be done, I hope, through extensive consultations.
Many are criticizing the fact that the U.S. changed its mind in relation to creating an interim Iraqi government within 2 months of what the U.S. calls the liberation of Iraq. A group of U.S. congressmen expect the U.S. to stay for a minimum of 5 years in Iraq. In Shune, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech, Radio News.
At the World Economic Forum this weekend, Paul Bremer, the U.S. Administrator for Iraq, said, quote, Iraqis have begun to enjoy life on their own terms and also started to embrace the responsibilities that freedom entails, end quote. Peace Watch spoke today with Lamisa Doni, who monitors the media throughout the Middle East, and asked her if the lives of her Iraqi relatives reflected the return to normalcy that Bremer spoke of.
No, I think there's less security. In fact, Baghdad has had no electricity for 2 days in some areas. There hasn't been water and electricity for 2 days. Sometimes there's some stunt of commerce returning, some trade and some business. But the other aspects of life are not good at all. People don't feel secure, don't feel safe. And with the scorching heat, without electricity and water, people's nerves are frayed. And there are more demonstrations all over against the U.S. and Britain every day.
Mm. Are you in constant contact with your relatives in Baghdad or Iraq?
Yes, and I'm in constant contact with people who are coming and going from Iraq, Iraqis as well as journalists as well, especially Iraqis who were in Jordan during the war and went back and then came back to Jordan. And many Iraqis did not go back. They just, like the man of the family, would go back to assess the situation. So, and they've arrested many people. They've arrested even people who used to work with them. Mm. I mean, today, the area where the British soldiers were killed, I think this has to be... What's happening has to be monitored very closely. The people in the area have been complaining of the way the soldiers have been coming into the houses, breaking into the houses with dogs, attacking women. I mean, the dogs attacking women. I mean, without any respect for the sanctity of their homes. And it was happening every day. And at the beginning, the British made agreements with some local leaders as liaisons, including tribal leaders. And these community leaders agreed to be liaisons. Some of them wanted to work with the British, and some of them wanted just to avert a confrontation between the population and to protect their population. Yesterday, what happened was these local leaders who were like liaisons with the British were telling the British, please, you cannot do that. You're making people very angry. And they warned them again and again, and the British continued like what the U.S. forces are doing in Afghanistan all the time, going into villages, terrorizing people, not respecting, just taking people, arresting them, people disappearing. So the people demonstrated in front of a local station, a former Iraqi police station, where there were British soldiers. And when they were not promised that these raids against the homes would stop, they killed the soldiers. This is what's happened in Iraq. It wasn't if they want to put it on Saddam's people, this is nonsense. It's people, local people, resisting in their own way and defending their homes. And it, this is very, very, very serious. I mean, in the end, they attacked the British soldiers and killed them. And today, the British have warned all of the people of that area, the local leaders, to either bring the people who the killers, as they call them, to give them up, or to surrender them, or all of that village, will, all of these villages will pay the price. And people are saying, already are saying that this is a collective punishment. Already, they came to punish us, not to liberate us. And we are local leaders. We cannot. We are not your police.
Are you talking about the British soldiers that were killed earlier this week?
Yes, six soldiers.
Six,
yes.
British soldiers.
There were
eight
injured in another area, and six. And it was not an ambush. It was the people of a village rising up against the British.
Because they failed to.
Because the British soldiers have been raiding the houses every day, terrorizing the people and drowning out people.
Okay.
So they rose up against them and they killed six.
How do you know this to be true, Lamis Adani?
Because unlike the American media, the Arab media is there on the spot interviewing people. We get news every day, excessive news, interviewing people.
Okay.
And there's many, many media people in Iraq spread all over. They go wherever it goes. And even there's a report in the BBC that confirmed what the Arab media has been saying, because the BBC also went today and had heard the same story. So I don't know what's happening, what you are getting in America, but... And here in Jordan, if something is not true, eventually we can know from the Iraqis who are coming back. But all of the journalists on the scene are saying the same thing, and they're interviewing people on the spot.
Mm.
People are saying, and now the biggest news today was that the British occupying forces have issued a warning to the people of the villages. So there were demonstrations, and people were saying this is imperialism. They were using the word imperialism in English, and we don't want you.
Correspondent Lamis Adani speaking with us from Amman, Jordan. On an historical note, Christopher Sprinkle, producer of the morning show at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, presents this commemoration of a notable literary figure whose words are regarded by many as just as relevant today, more than a half century after his death.
This day in history, 100 years ago, on June 25th, 1903, a baby was born in Mata Hari, India, and christened Eric Arthur Blair. His parents were members of the Indian Civil Service, and after an education at Eton College in England, the baby, who had grown into a man, joined the Indian Imperial Police in Burma in 1922. An experience that later found creative release in the novel Burmese Days, published in 1934. He suffered a lifelong distrust and hatred of autocratic government and began truly making his views known in the form of essays, which he was a master at. In the 1940s, he published his two most famous works, one a modern beast fable attacking Stalinism, and the other a dystopian novel setting forth his fears of an intrusively bureaucratized state of the future. He once said, "If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever." Needless to say, he viewed life as a glass half full. No, seriously. He was a realist, some might say pessimist, but all would say he was damn near clairvoyant. I am talking about, of course, the man whom history remembers as George Orwell. His most famous books are Animal Farm and 1984. Today is his 100th birthday, and we honor him with a reading of an excerpt from his most famous of essays entitled Politics and the English Language, written in May of 1945. Number 1. Never use a metaphor, simile, or other figure of speech which you are used to seeing in print. Number 2. Never use a long word where a short one will do. Number 3. If it is possible to cut a word out, always cut it out. Number 4. Never use the passive where you can use the active. Number 5. Never use a foreign phrase, a scientific word, or a jargon word if you can think of an everyday English equivalent. Number 6. Break any of those rules sooner than say anything outright barbarous. These rules sound elementary, and so they are, but they demand a deep change of attitude in anyone who has grown used to writing in the style now fashionable. I have not here been considering the literary use of language, but merely language as an instrument for expressing and not for concealing or preventing thought. Stuart Chase and others have come near to claiming that all abstract words are meaningless, and have used this as a pretext for advocating a kind of political quietism. Since you don't know what fascism is, how can you struggle against fascism? One need not swallow such absurdities as this, but one ought to recognize that the present political chaos is connected with the decay of language, and that one can probably bring about some improvement by starting at the verbal end. If you simplify your English, you are freed from the worst follies of orthodoxy. You cannot speak any of the necessary dialects, and when you make a stupid remark, its stupidity will be obvious even to yourself. Political language, and with variations this is true of all political parties, from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. One cannot change this all in a moment, but one can at least change one's own habits. And from time to time one can even, if one jeers loudly enough, send some worn-out and useless phrase, some jackboot, Achilles heel, hotbed, melting pot, acid test, veritable inferno, or other lump of verbal refuse, into the dustbin where it belongs. And now, a sampling from his seminal works, Animal Farm, in 1984. First, from 1984, quote, "Nearly all children nowadays were horrible. What was worst of all was that by means of such organizations as the spies, they were systematically turned into ungovernable little savages, and yet this produced in them no tendency whatever to rebel against the discipline of the party. On the contrary, they adored the party and everything connected with it. All their ferocity was turned outwards, against the enemies of the state, against foreigners, traitors, saboteurs, thought criminals. It was almost normal for people over 30 to be frightened of their own children." And from Animal Farm, quote, "The Seven Commandments are abridged for the last time. Simply reading, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others."
I am an American. I have the right to remain silent. I wish to refuse that right. And if you refuse that right, then everything you say can and will be used against you. Well, I am a poet also, so that is what I want.
I want to tell the story of a 17-year-old pregnant girl who sees her reflection in her womb that is the shape of things to come, who places her sad memories in an hourglass where each teardrop tells of the time that someone broke her heart.
Tax dollars and jet engines make you run to your balcony, break out your Sony, and attempt thin and one-dimensional recordings of the city. Baghdad is unstrung in a corset of sound. Murder and chaos are concussive. They don't just shout in your face, they grab you by the collarbone and blow into it.
I do what I'm supposed to do. Learn to look beyond the signifiers of class and color. Understand that beyond every revolution is another story, another oppression.
Happy birthday, George Orwell. We still read you. We still remember. Excerpts of this essay were taken from a biographical essay of George Orwell written by Richard A. Johnson and copyrighted in 1993 by Grolier Incorporated. The voices of those still carrying on the legacy of George Orwell are Steve Connell, Jorge Montarosa, Jerry Quickly, and Amani Tolliver.
Piece prepared by KPFK producer Christopher Sprinkle. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, Gaza and the West Bank. Is it possible peace is on the horizon?